Before we begin our case, our marshal for the Supreme Court is going to show you how we keep track of time. And we will be using these color-coded cards. If you look in, for me, it's the upper left-hand corner of my screen. You'll see a green card and it says start. Then you'll see in a little while a yellow card that tells you you have 5 minutes to go. And then at last, a red card that says stop. I will help you keep track of the red card, but if a justice has asked a question, you always can answer the question, even though the red card is up. Excuse me, but I probably won't let you wander off into other topics. So with that in mind, are you both prepared to proceed?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Then I will call our first case of the morning, State versus Van Beek. And counsel, will you begin, please?
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Good morning. My name is Jay Pusick, and I represent Heather Van Beek. I'll be discussing two issues this morning. First, did the officers retaining and taking of Ms. Van Beek's license to a squad car result in a consensual encounter becoming a seizure? And second, did the officer unlawfully extend the stop for the purpose of allowing a drug-sniffing dog to arrive on scene? As to the first question, it's clear that in order to determine if and when Ms. Van Beek was seized, this court must consider the totality of the circumstances. Under that standard, Ms. Van Beek was seized when the officer took her license away. The factors supporting that conclusion are first that the officer positioned himself behind Ms. Van Beek's vehicle in a classic traffic stop formation. He utilized a spotlight and overhead takedown lights to illuminate the inside of her vehicle. He approached and made contact with her as if it were a traffic stop. When Ms. Van Beek's passenger, Mr. Sitzberger, offered to provide their personal information to him verbally, the officer refused that request and indicated to them that the only thing that would satisfy him was a physical driver's license. There were two officers on scene from the very beginning. And finally, the officer, once he received her license, he took it with him back to his squad car.
So, counsel, there's an argument that it was consensual to hand over the license and that once the officers have it, that they can go run a check. So how do you respond to that argument?
Sure. So as we know, an officer is free during a consensual encounter to request someone's license to examine it. And so, you know, in this case, I think it's clear that it was a request to have the license to see it. There is sort of a tinge of authority there when the passenger offers to provide the information verbally and the officer rejects that. I think that that's bordering on the officer using his authority. I think, you know, it's certainly something that I think this court should consider. I mean, it doesn't transform it into a seizure on its own, but I think it's significant here. With regard to the consent, I don't think that consent works in this case for at least two reasons. First, here the state has the burden by clear and convincing evidence to prove that Ms. Van Beek freely and voluntarily consented, not just to the officer examining her license, but taking it away to his squad car. And I don't think they've carried that burden on this record, where when the officer asked for the license, he didn't say that he was going to take it away from her. He didn't give any indication of that. What he said was, I need your information for my report, indicating that he just wanted to have that information so he could put it in a document later on.
Counsel, are people allowed legally to drive cars without driver's licenses? Or how's
no.
that work in Wisconsin?
No. No, I obviously you need to be a valid licensed driver to drive a vehicle. Additionally, you need to have possession of that license on your person while you're operating a motor vehicle under Wisconsin law.
Just to, I don't want to let you finish answering that question, but I want to sort of nail down the moment here that you're talking about. So the initial walk up to the window, that's fine. We don't have a seizure there. Would you agree with that?
I do agree.
And the request for a license, for the driver's license, even when they just, he said, no, can I have your license, please? Would you agree no seizure at that point?
I think it's closer, but I still agree no seizure at that point.
Okay. So the moment you argue there's a seizure is when the officer takes that and walks back to the car. That's the moment that you're arguing a seizure took place.
Yes.
Okay.
So getting back to the sort of the record that we have here, he didn't give him notice. He told him it was for his report. The passenger here, again, I think it's important that he offers to just provide it. Hey, if you just need our names, we'll give you that information. You can write it down and then you can put it in a report. And he pushes back on that, the officer does, and says that's not good enough for him. You know, he wants an actual driver's license. But when he asks for it, he just says he's going to compare faces. That's why he needs the physical license. Not, hey, I need your license so I can have the information when I go back to my car. I just need to compare your faces with the driver's license so that I know you're not lying to me about who you are. And so,
what's the best case for your argument that the officer somehow was doing something inappropriate for, you know, and is asking for a driver's license?
No, I don't think it was inappropriate for him to ask for it. No.
Okay. So I guess I'm missing your argument. You seem like you're making a lot out of that today.
Out of the request, you mean out of his rejection of the passenger's offer? Well,
yeah,
I mean,
it's not uncommon for law enforcement to want someone to not be able to just pick a name and say that's who they are that day, right? I mean, it happens all the time. So it is not uncommon to ask for a piece of identification to verify you have something that supports who you say you are.
Sure.
If you're spending a lot of time on that argument, it falls flat with me anyway.
I appreciate that. And I don't mean to get so, to give you that impression that that's the crux of my argument. The most important factor here in this case is that the officer took the license back to a squad car. I don't think it was a seizure when he said, no, I'd rather have a driver's license. I mean, I think it's important to remember that the context of where we were at that point is a consensual encounter between an officer of the law and some citizens who are in a public space. And so I guess I don't have a problem with him saying, no, I'd rather have a license, and them consensually providing that or agreeing to provide that. My problem is that, and if the officer had taken the license at that point, looked at it and called it in over his personal radio or his handheld radio, or even written it down on a pad of paper like he did with the information on his second contact, I think I would have, you know, that would have been fine as far as I can see.
So, counsel, you know, he asked them for their information for his report. Seems reasonable he might do something more than just peek at a driver's license right there if you're going to make some report out of it. Would you respond to that argument?
Sure. I think that given I think it goes down to what the officer communicated to them at the side of the road there, when he said it's for the report, it's just to compare faces that I need this driver's license. And so I think it's reasonable, given what he communicated, for Ms. Van Beek to believe, or any reasonable person to believe, that he was going to just compare the faces, look at it, and maybe write down the information in a notepad. Again, he did that on his second contact. He sat there and wrote information while they spoke. It's certainly not out of the realm of possibility, and it's something that officers do, I think, regularly. He also could have utilized a handheld radio. That's a factor we've seen in a number of the cases from other jurisdictions that are similar to this one, where courts have pointed out that officers using a handheld radio in the person's presence to call in the information kept it a consensual encounter. And so I think those are two things the officer could have done in order to, you know, not take the license away from her.
He could have, but did he need to? I mean, you know, really what we're talking about is the scope of the consent that was given. So, you know, your argument is that consent, that there was consent to look at the license, to look at the license for the purposes of an officer doing a report. You're arguing that maybe there was a more limited means by which the individuals in the car might have presumed that, this report would have taken place. But does this sort of vitiate the idea that he could take it back to his car? That would be within the scope of the permission to fill out a report as well.
Sure. A couple of points about that. I mean, I think first, again, we sort of have to remember that this is a consensual encounter between these two. I think it would add an interesting element into this if the officer had said, hey, I'm going to take this back to my car. I'm going to, do that. But he didn't say that. And I think, again, it's the state's burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that this consent, not only to view the license, but to take it back to the car, was freely and voluntarily given. And I don't think they've met that burden. The officer didn't tell them that's what he was going to do. I don't think it's reasonable to assume that when I give my license to an officer who's just asking to compare my face and for his report, I don't think it's reasonable to automatically say, oh, well, he's going to take it back to his car with him. I don't see that. I don't think it's a reasonable assumption. Beyond that, the second point I want to make about that is I think that, and this is where the rejection of the offer to write the information down comes in a little bit, is that I think once the officer sort of asserts a little bit of authority there and rejects that, I think it's reasonable for Ms. Van Beek to assume that she doesn't have a whole lot of control over how this encounter is going to go. They've already been rejected once by the officer. For her then to stand up and say, no, actually, I don't think I want you to take that away from me on second thought. I don't want you to go to your squad car. I don't think a reasonable person would be in that position under these circumstances.
In your argument just a little while ago, in response to Justice Hagedorn's question about when did the seizure start, you said the seizure started when the officer walked back to the car. And I'm assuming you meant when he walked back to his squad with the license, with the two licenses.
Yes, that is what I meant.
Is it possible that the seizure began after that? Is it possible that the seizure began when he walked back to Ms. Van Beek's car? Or do you not see any way where that could happen? That is, that after he takes the license, he goes back and he does a record check and gets what he needs for his report or whatever. But then he goes back to the car and doesn't give her license. Could the seizure have started then? Or is it your argument that it had to have started when he carried the license back to he being the officer carried the license back to the squad car?
So under my analysis, that is my position, that when he carried the license back to a squad car, a seizure occurred for the reasons that I've stated. Now, I can appreciate that the court may not agree with me on that conclusion. And I think that looking at the whole sequence here, I think that even if this court were to conclude that a seizure didn't happen exactly when I'm saying it happened, certainly a seizure occurred somewhere down the line here. And I think at any point you can stop me, but the officer takes the license, he walks. And I'll say this before I go on. I assume the justices have all watched the body camera video here. If anybody hasn't, I would encourage them to do so, or even to do it again after this argument, because I'm going to be making a number of comments about it. But, when the officer walks away, he first confers with another officer. They have completely irrelevant and unrelated conversation about a dispatcher. The officer communicates that he sees absolutely nothing suspicious about what's going on, but he's going to run their information and get them on their way. He goes into a squad car. He calls the information into a dispatcher. He gets returns on those driver's licenses fairly quickly. And then he gets a message from a lieutenant telling him, hey, by the way, Ms. Van Beek was the victim of a drug overdose earlier this year. And of course, he immediately then, once he gets that information, that's really what changes his approach here. He immediately calls for a drug dog. He waits another minute and a half, not getting a response. He exits the car, confers with another officer again. You know, he verbalizes his concern about what he's doing. You know, do I really have enough to just hold them here until the drug dog arrives? And then he goes back up to the window and he starts questioning Ms. Van Beek again while holding on to her license. And so I think my point with that, you know, that series of events took about 5 or 6 minutes. And so, yes, I agree with you. If the court concludes that I'm wrong about the seizure happening when he first walks away, certainly at some point along that continuum, she was seized. And I would argue it happened, you know, obviously my position is that it happened right up front, but every additional factor as you go into that sequence makes it more and more likely that a seizure occurred.
And counsel, I just watched the video and I counted 10 minutes between the time that he had the license, took the license back into his car to the time the dog got there.
That is correct, right.
So you had 8 in your brief, but it really was 10.
Well, I apologize.
Holding that license until the dog actually arrived. So your position is that's an extension of even whatever it was consensual and what didn't rise to the level of seizure. If we were to find that, it's your position that at some point during those 10 minutes, it was it became unlawful.
Correct.
Counsel, so assume for the moment that the taking of the licenses back to the car was consensual. Okay. How does that transform something that's elongated? Because, you know, think about this big picture as I was, you know, working through this case. You know, the whole concept here is this is a show of authority seizure. That's the line of cases. So it's not just, you know, just would we have felt free to leave at sort of any given point in time. That is the test, but it's in the context of the officer showing authority, and that show of authority being a mental seizure, if you will, as opposed to an actual physical, you know, grabbing of somebody's seizure or preventing them from leaving. So how does the consent, I'm back at the car and I've got the consent to run my, to do my report, right? And in the course of that time, I start to get suspicious. I get some more information here that changes that. How does the consent then dissipate during the course of that simply because the officer has now become more suspicious?
Well, a couple of things. I don't think that, I mean, obviously my position is that there wasn't consent. You've asked me to assume that there was.
Correct.
Yeah. I think an additional problem with consent here is that it's a standard sort of axiom of the Fourth Amendment consent law that a person that freely and voluntarily they can give their consent, but they also remain free to revoke that consent during the whatever's being consented to. And so when the officer walks away, Ms. Van Beek loses the ability to communicate with him, loses the ability to revoke her consent. And I think that's a significant factor here. I think there's a number of...
But I want you to assume for the purposes of my question, and I hear that. I want you to assume for the purposes of my question that taking the license back to the car was acceptable and that consent was given for that.
Sure. So assuming in that scenario, consent is given, the officer goes back to his car. I think it's important to keep in mind that when he goes back to his car, even under this consent theory, he doesn't have reasonable suspicion to conduct a seizure at that point. He doesn't know enough to establish reasonable suspicion. And I can get to that, and I'd like to get to that a little bit later if the court is interested. But he doesn't have reasonable suspicion. He's not even close. He gets into the car and he learns some new information there. That's true. And it's information that he can consider in coming to that, in coming to a decision about a seizure, right? He learns two things, that Ms. Van Beek had this overdose, and that Mr. Sitzberger is on community supervision. Okay. My first point about that is there are factors that give him some suspicion. I mean, clearly, subjectively, they did. I think the video clearly shows it's the overdose information that causes him immediately to sort of do a 180 on this encounter. But those factors, you know, they're not enough to create reasonable suspicion, even with the other things that he already knows. And so while they give him what we might call a hunch about Miss Van Beek, hey, she's been a drug user in the past. She may be a drug user now. I better get a drug dog here to just double check and make sure there's nothing in the car.
So is it your position that, do you think that the police officer ever had reasonable suspicion here?
My position is that he did not. And I can go through that a little bit more in detail, but I, just to finish out on Justice Hagedorn's question, he does have some additional factors that give him this hunch, not enough for reasonable suspicion. He goes back to the car, and when he, under this scenario, when he continues to question them while holding on to her license, I mean, certainly at that point, it's a seizure. I think at that point, to answer the question directly, whatever consent was there is gone, because he's now told her he just wants to get her license, or he just wants to get her information for his report, and he's going to get her on her way. And now here he comes back from the car after 5-6 minutes, and he's not getting her on her way. He's now asking her sort of questions that are probing and interrogatory in a way. And so I think at that point, no reasonable person, certainly at that point, would feel free to leave or otherwise terminate.
And so is the dividing line for you, if the officer came back to the car and gave the license back but continued questioning, would your argument change?
It may. I mean, I haven't given a ton of, I've thought about this scenario from a lot of different angles. As you can imagine, I have not considered that one particularly. I would want to think about it a little bit more, but just off the cuff, I'm going to tell you that I think it certainly may change. Had he given the license back, it certainly would be a very different scenario. I'm not willing yet to commit to the idea that she's totally free at that point, but it certainly would be a big difference. And I think that the case law that we have bears that out, that retaining the license is a very significant factor in the seizure question. I mean, the most significant point on that is the juxtaposition of Royer and Mendenhall in this case, two cases that are remarkably factually similar.
Are we to make anything of the fact that law enforcement was responding to an anonymous call about two people sitting in a truck for about an hour? A person came with a backpack to the truck and left. This is about 12:15 in the morning, and they respond to that. So they go to this location on the side of an intersection of a highway, and they then pursue that. And initially they think, okay, this seems legit. Then they go back and find that this person had some drug issues, right? And then they proceed slightly differently, and they think, there might be more to this initial call. Is that in any way, I haven't heard any commentary about the background here that led up to the initial contact. Should we just forget about that and the responses that were given?
No, I would have liked to have gotten to it during this initial part. I just got caught up in answering questions. But I mean, I think that to try to be very brief about it, I think the information at that initial stage can be divided into what the officer knew from his observations. And those are that Miss Van Beek was sitting in her car with a friend together for about 10 minutes, and that it was midnight, you know. And he also knew, of course, that this caller, completely anonymous, said that the car had been there for an hour and that someone had approached the vehicle. The person happened to be wearing a backpack, and at some point, unknown, at some point after approaching the car, they left. Okay. So
there are at least competing versions of which event an officer might believe, right? Either they're there for an hour, could be a drug deal that went down, right? Approach, midnight, car, backpack. And then the officer responds to the anonymous call to explore that and initially thinks this might be legit. Sorry, that's a dog.
So
Supreme Court.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think that those factors are enough to get us there. I mean, first of all, with what the officer knew, I don't know that it's, I don't know that we can say that there's a necessarily an inconsistency there between the caller's report of an hour and basically Mr. Sitzberger saying, hey, we've been here for 10 minutes. I mean, a car can certainly be somewhere for 10 minutes and then Mr. Sitzberger can get there, or sorry, a car can be somewhere for an hour. Mr. Sitzberger can get there 10 minutes ago. Both of those things are easily true. And that's,
can you also respond to, did the officer even know which car this was? Like, there was no information about a license plate or anything. This is just an assumption that this is the truck that he happened to see, that the person happened to be calling about. And then also, would you address if, was there any indication of any kind of transaction that conspired between the person who had a backpack supposedly that came out?
No. So, I mean, as to the officer, I mean, he didn't know for sure that this was the truck. Of course, he told us that he drove up and down the street looking for another truck and he didn't find one. So he assumed this was the one. I don't know. I mean, I think what that gets to is that this caller was, we have an extremely low quantity and quality of information here. There's really nothing reliable about this tip. It's uncorroborated. And we know that that kind of tip is unreliable. It's uncorroborated because
I thought the tip was there's a truck at a location and 6 minutes later he goes there and the truck's there.
May I respond?
Yes, yes, you may, of course.
Right. I guess that's the point. He responds. There is a truck there. When he responds, he looks. I think he's conscientious. He looks for other trucks because he's not sure if this is the one. He doesn't find any. And so he says, this must be it. Now, I don't have a huge, I don't have a huge problem with that per se, because I think that him walking up to her and having a conversation at that point was a consensual encounter. I think the problem starts when he walks away with her license. So I don't have a problem with him saying, oh, this must be the truck. I'm just going to check in and see if these are the folks. But I think what we're getting at here with this, with Justice Dowd's question, is the amount of information that we had on this call was just extremely low. And it's not really, it's worth little to nothing in this analysis here as a result.
Okay, thank you. Attorney Rosenauer, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please do.
Good morning, may it please the court. I'm Attorney Scott Rosenauer for the state of Wisconsin. I'll gladly talk about the seizure issue a lot. I'm sure the court has questions about it. But before going there, I want to just point out that there are a few different paths this court could take for affirming. And perhaps the simplest path is to first conclude that Officer Edsel lawfully seized Van Beek, assuming that he did, pursuant to his community caretaker authority so he could run a record check. And if the court reaches that conclusion, it should further hold that Officer Edsel had reasonable suspicion after the record check, which justified an extension of the stop for some follow-up questions of Van Beek and her passenger.
Can I just ask you about that right off the bat, Mr. Rose? Now, doesn't that open the door for all kinds of activity on behalf of officers? I mean, forget this case. If you're saying that you're actually seized at the time an officer just goes up to ask some questions about what's going on, and because they have the right to do that and then the right to go run a license, officers could, anytime they want, say it's community caretaker. I mean, where would the line be? I'm that's more worrisome to me than an officer just going up and checking on, making sure these people are okay and checking out the situation, which it looks like what happens. So tell me where the line would be for what you're asking us to do.
I do understand that concern. And I think the answer really is in the Allenbecker case that I discussed in my brief. So one point the court made in that case is that the officer there did not just randomly stop Mr. Allenbecker and ask for his license. The officer in that case pulled up to Allenbecker's car because it was disabled on the side of the road. Similar thing here. The officer didn't just randomly single out Van Beek for a stop and a record check. He responded to a concern call about suspicious behavior. And once he got there, they voluntarily handed over their license. So he's not randomly singling her out. He's not forcing her to hand over her license. Once she agrees to do that, I think it's okay to go run the license and see if it's valid.
Okay, but let's follow this down the road. It's community caretaker. If I give you that, once the officer doesn't have any, everything seems fine, right? So when does community caretaker end then? Because all he finds out when he runs it is that 9 months ago, she had a drug overdose. And then he also finds out that the passenger was on supervision, but he has no idea for what. And so that's what he gets when he goes and runs this license. So where does the community caretaker end?
I didn't exactly argue it this far down the road in my brief, just because there was a word limit that I was running up against. But in the circuit court level, the prosecutor did argue that the community caretaker doctrine authorized Edsel to ask follow-up questions, mainly because he learned that the passenger, Sitzberger, was on probation. And that opens up a whole can of worms, basically, that this officer, pursuant to his police department's policies, he has to do a full questioning or whatever you want to call it to get as much complete information as he can from somebody who's on probation, who's out and about at midnight to see what he's doing there. And then Edsel has to write a report about the interaction and send it to the probation officer. And I believe everyone who's on probation, at least it's a standard rule supervision, probationers have to report all of their law enforcement contacts with their probation officer, I believe, the very next day. So I think under this community caretaker idea, Officer Edsel could go back and ask them some follow-up questions to see why this guy who's on probation was out and about doing something that seemed a little suspicious at midnight and see where he's coming from. But
Mr. Rosenau, he takes the driver's license, the driver's license. Mm-hmm. I get the passenger's on probation and they need to follow up on that and make sure that the probationer checked in with their agent the next Monday morning. Fine. But he takes the driver's license and then doesn't return it for 10 minutes. I'm trying really hard to wrap my mind around the community caretaker notion here. There is no indication that the car was disabled. I watched the video too. It's not like there was a winter storm or any storm, or it didn't look like anyone was in distress. Are you saying something other than anytime there's an anonymous call and there is a car on the side of the road with people in it, that's community caretaker? Is there any time when that wouldn't be?
I guess just to be clear, I'm not asking for a bright line rule. It is a totality of the circumstances approach. So under all of the facts in this case, I think it was reasonable to ask for the license. And that's really what the Allenbecker case says too, that it wasn't just a random stop and request for a license. It was reasonable to request a license under those circumstances.
Under the community caretaker theory.
Right. And I think it was here too, for a few reasons. And I realize that most community caretaker cases in Wisconsin deal with a situation where the officer is performing a search or seizure, usually a search like entering a home, to see if somebody inside needs help, needs medical care, that sort of thing. But that's not the only time when this caretaker doctrine applies. In order to apply, there needs to be a bona fide community caretaker function, which just means that the officer's action has to be totally divorced from investigating and uncovering evidence of a possible criminal violation. And that's pretty broad in scope. It just means the officer has to be wearing one of his many hats besides the one of investigating possible crimes. And I think in this case, just like in Allenbecker, I think it was reasonable to ask for a license because, and this gets to the sort of disabled vehicle idea, I think the fact that Van Beek's truck was not disabled actually makes the request for the license all the more reasonable because she was going to leave otherwise. In Allenbecker, the guy was maybe going to have to call a tow truck, but it was still reasonable to ask for his license to see if he could legally drive away. So I think if anything, the fact that Van Beek's truck was not disabled made it more reasonable to see if she had a valid license.
I gotta tell you, I just see it the other way. I see if the car is disabled and she can move from that location, she's not disabled, she's not stranded in the middle of the night, and there is absolutely no need for a police officer to swoop in to become a community caretaker. I guess, let me ask it this way. What caretaking function was this officer trying to perform other than investigating these two for possibly dealing drugs? What was the caretaker function?
I think ultimately it was public safety for a couple of different reasons. One is, like the Elmbecker case says, if you have a driver's license, you presumably know how to safely drive a vehicle. If you don't have a valid license, that's a public safety problem. And along similar lines, checking them to see if they're wanted or have outstanding warrants for arrest, that's also a public safety community caretaking function. If one of them had an outstanding arrest warrant, that wouldn't mean that he's investigating a crime. All it means is he's investigating whether they have an outstanding warrant for an arrest. They might have missed a hearing in court or something. That's not a crime. But
so the way that you're looking at it is, just so we're clear, just so I'm clear, is you're viewing the community caretaker as the officers are taking care of the whole community by contacting these two, as opposed to the officer is making contact with Ms. Van Beek and her passenger to perform some sort of community caretaking function that will assist them.
Exactly. And in fact, the Elmbecker case frames the issue the exact same way, right? The very, I think, second or first sentence into that opinion, the Court of Appeals says, the question before us today is whether the officer could seize Mr. Elmbecker to run a record check or status check after learning that he did not need help with his disabled car. So in Elmbecker, there was no dispute that the record check, checking him to see if he had a valid license and outstanding warrants, there was no dispute that the record check did not help him with his disabled car in any way. Helping him wasn't the reason for the caretaking function. Public safety, making sure he had a valid license, checking him for outstanding warrants, that's the community caretaking function in that case.
Counsel, your argument would expand the community caretaker doctrine to every single stop, as I understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. That can't be right.
No, again, I don't think, well, first of all, this wasn't a stop at the beginning. It was a consensual encounter, and they voluntarily handed over their licenses upon request. And like I said a few minutes ago in response to Justice Kraske's questions, we're not asking for a bright line rule in this case. We're just saying, tied to the facts of this case, which are very similar to Elmbecker, it was reasonable to ask for a license. And once she freely handed it over, it was reasonable to go run a record check for 5 minutes, because otherwise, what's the point of asking for a license if you can't go check it to see if it's actually a real ID versus a fake ID or something like that?
Counsel, I just wondered if you got to either of the other two. You said you had three reasons to affirm, and that's all I was going to say. I'll leave it to Justice Ann Walsh Bradley now.
Thank you. So when did the seizure occur? Obviously, if you're invoking the community caretaker exception, it's an exception to a seizure. Do I hear you correctly that you are invoking the community caretaker exception either when, when he takes the card back to the car, is that when you're invoking the community caretaker exception? It almost sounded to me like you were invoking it when he asked for the card, but I don't know if you're really saying that. So when are you invoking it? And then we'll know when the seizure occurred.
That's a good question. Thank you for asking. So I think that the state's position is, if the court agrees with Van Beek that the seizure began when the officer walked away with her license, then that's when the community caretaker doctrine would kick in to justify the warrantless seizure. And to get back to Justice Ziegler's question, if I may, there are a couple other arguments the state's making. I didn't expect to talk this much about community caretaker, honestly. I expected more questions about the seizure issue. So just very briefly, the alternative arguments are, the officer had reasonable suspicion even before obtaining the license, reasonable suspicion which would justify a brief 5 or 6 minute Terry stop to run the record check. And the other argument is, what I was expecting to get more questions about, the seizure issue. There just wasn't a seizure until sometime after the record check, probably not until the officer asked Van Beek to step out of the truck.
So with respect to that second one, the fact that he is on body camera saying, I don't see anything suspicious as he's taking the licenses back to the car, you really think you want to go with reasonable suspicion at that point?
I think so. It is an objective standard. It's not a subjective test. So it doesn't matter what the officer subjectively thought. It matters what he knew.
So it's based on the fact that there was this anonymous tip that doesn't have a lot of corroboration about people that are in a car, and it's 12:15 at night.
I think there's a little more to it than that. So it, like you said, it is past midnight, which I think is somewhat suspicious. They were sitting there for, the anonymous caller said, more than an hour or about an hour, one of those.
Do drug transactions take that long? I mean, that part, I don't know that that benefits the argument at all. Wouldn't you, if you're doing a drug transaction, don't you want to get in and get out?
I think that a couple of different things were presumably going on here. I think that the person with the backpack who approached the truck, possibly, this is the reasonable suspicion argument. It's not necessarily what happened, but it's what might have happened. The person with the backpack who reportedly went to the truck and then left might have sold some drugs to the two people in the truck, and then they sat there, the two people, consuming the drugs. And Officer Edsel testified at the suppression hearing that when people are sitting in the truck, longer than that, I think is what he said. I think he meant longer than 30 minutes, that they're usually using narcotics based on his training and experience. So the idea is that there was a drug sale followed by drug use. So I think when you look at the person with the backpack, the time of night, the amount of time they're sitting in the truck, it's all pretty suspicious. And I think there was corroboration, and this court found corroboration of an anonymous tip under very similar facts in the Williams case about 15 to 20 years ago. And what we have here, like in Williams, is anonymous caller says there's a vehicle, specific vehicle, in this case a truck, at a specific location, North 6th Street and Superior Avenue, and there are two people sitting there. Officer Edsel goes to that exact address, finds a truck, and finds two people sitting in it. So I think that's corroboration, enough to at least lend some reliability to this anonymous call.
I want to ask a question about the consent as far as first taking the driver's license. As I read your brief, I believe it's your position that Ms. Van Beek consented to the officer having her license, right?
Right.
And if I understand the argument correctly, it's because when the officer asked her, number one, he asked her, and after he asked her, she could have said no? Yes?
Well, there are a few reasons. That's one of them. So I guess maybe it's, I don't want to get too technical, but I wouldn't necessarily say Van Beek concedes. I don't think that's really the standard. I think the standard is whether a reasonable person in Van Beek's position would think that she was consenting to depart with her license for a few minutes. I'd like to quote what Justice Hagedorn said a few minutes to opposing counsel. Isn't this really about the scope of consent? Isn't this about whether someone in Van Beek's position would think they were consenting to more than just a brief peek at the license? And I think that's really the heart of this seizure question is, what would a reasonable person think Van Beek was consenting to? And imagine two other extremes. One extreme is the officer says, may I take your license to run a record check for 5 minutes in my squad car? And she says, yes. I think even my opposing counsel will agree there's no seizure during the record check because it's consensual. You can't consent to being seized. If you're consenting, then you're not seized by definition. On the other extreme, if the officer said, may I run a record check for 5 minutes with your license? And she said, no, give it back. We wouldn't be here today in that scenario either, because there would unquestionably be a seizure once he walked away with her license.
I seem to read your brief as distinguishing between an officer asking for a license and an officer demanding a license. And I just got to say, there may or may not have been times in my life when I've had a little bit of a lead foot and perhaps been pulled over by a police officer. You know, look, in my experience, and I'm guessing the experience of many people, there just isn't ever the give me your license. Generally, and I know that police officers are trained to say, may I please have your license? So I guess I don't understand us being able to distinguish on whether or not it was asked or demanded, because I think that they do ask, and they ask with the authority of a police car behind them. In this case, the bright light shining on, he's fully uniformed. Really, what choice is there?
I think the traffic stop situation is different than what we have here, because if you are pulled over for speeding, you are seized the second you acquiesce to the show of authority. They turn on their red and blue lights, and when you pull over, that is when you're seized. And if you're seized and the officer asks for your driver's license while you're driving a car, I think legally you have to give it over. So I think that's different than what we have here, which is unquestionably, Van Beek doesn't dispute that There was no seizure when the officer turned on his spotlight and walked up to the car and talked to them for about 45 seconds before asking for their licenses. And Van Beek also doesn't dispute that it was consensual when she handed her license over. And I do want to respond to something that opposing counsel said today about this sort of hint of authority when the officer said, no, I want your license. I think it was still pretty consensual at that point, because what Officer Edsel said was, could I get your guy's information? He didn't say, can I have your license? He said, could I get your information? And then the passenger, Sitzberger, said, do you want me to just tell you it or write it down, or do you want to see my license? So it wasn't like the officer was demanding or insisting to see the license. All Officer Edsel was doing was clarifying what he meant by, could I get your information? So he was just saying, no, I want your license so I can compare faces, that sort of thing.
Counsel, I want to just address briefly. So assume for the moment, for the purposes of my question, that consent covered the taking the license back to the car. Could you walk me through the possible points at which you believe reasonable suspicion shows up to take that and, you know, actually affect a legal seizure protected by reasonable suspicion?
Sure. So, well, to be clear, I do think there's reasonable suspicion before Officer Edsel even obtained the driver's license. And I think if the court doesn't want to go that far, I think there definitely was reasonable suspicion right after the record check, once the officer learned Sitzberger was on probation and Van Beek had a drug overdose earlier that year.
Okay. And that's the moment then when, so we've already got, you know, potential drug deal going on. He's at least thinking that the officer might be, but once he finds out that, doesn't see anything in the conversation, but once he finds out that these are people who are maybe known to, or at least one of them known to struggle with drugs, that becomes enough for him to reasonably suspect that something illegal had been occurring or was occurring.
I think so. And I think it's not just individually looking at different facts. I think we have to really look at them all together. And I don't want to repeat all the stuff I said a few minutes ago, but when you have the possible drug deal with the guy with the backpack going up to the truck, them sitting there for an hour, which is consistent with drug use, according to Officer Edsel's testimony, and then the prior drug overdose, I think when you put all those three drug-related things together, I think that paints a pretty clear picture that there's at least reasonable suspicion of illegal drug possession going on.
Suppose that's not the case. Suppose that there's no reasonable suspicion that shows up then. And do you think the officer, when he walks back up to the car, needed to return the license, or could he ask questions and retain the license in your view on the basis of the scope of consent that was given?
So I think the test is whether the retention is unduly long, and I don't think it was unduly long to keep the licenses once he went back up to Van Beek's truck. I think it's still a consensual encounter at that point. If she wasn't seized when he had her license 30, 40 feet away in the squad car, I don't see how she'd be seized when he has a license right outside her window talking to her about it. Like, sure, it might have been awkward for her to say, you know, can I just have my license back? I'd like to get out of here. Most people wouldn't feel comfortable doing that, but under this sort of, maybe legal fiction is the wrong expression, but under this sort of concept of consent that we have that the United States Supreme Court has adopted a long time ago, a reasonable person in this position would feel free to say, give me my license back, even though Van Beek maybe didn't feel free to do that. Maybe most people wouldn't, but a reasonable person would.
I want to jump in because I am chafing at the bit as to, so to speak anyway, at the idea of what a reasonable person would do. And your comments, of course, indicate there may be a difference between what happens in reality and what we say legally a reasonable person would do. You see, most of this stuff, I think it's a reasonable person isn't really invoked. You just said that you thought maybe a reasonable person wouldn't be asking for the license back under this circumstance. And I agree with you, you know, under this circumstance. reasonable suspicion. 1/2 hour sitting, the officer testified that that's suggestive of drug dealing. How crazy is that? You know, so I really am bothered when the law doesn't mesh with reality. And I guess let me focus on a question after now that I've vented. And that is it your position that consent, when she hands over the license, or any driver hands over the license, they are consenting to the officer taking the license back and for a period of time, however long it takes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes to be detained for that period of time. Is that your position as a matter of law?
Yeah, I think so, unless there are some circumstances that really point the other way. And I cited an Eighth Circuit federal case in my brief called United States versus Carpenter. And that was very similar to what we have here. The officer asked for the license, the guy hands it over, and the Eighth Circuit said that we could reasonably think that the person was consenting to a 4 to 5 minute record check. And in this case, it was between 5 and 6 minutes. So I think it's
piggybacking off what Justice Ann Walsh Bradley said, fine, if I give you that, the consent to the record check, when he comes back to the car and it's 10 minutes and he's still holding the license. And by the way, he doesn't ask about the backpack at all on what happened there. He's asking them to repeat their addresses. He's asking for the friend's phone number who they were meeting, which they give him. This is the conversation that's going on, which is clearly stalling for the canine. So what about that? At what point is the consent? You consent to 4 to 5 minutes to check? Fine. What are they consenting to, 10 minutes to wait for a drug dog?
Well, they didn't know a drug dog had been called. So if they did, they maybe would have said, we'd like our licenses back so we could leave. But I think ultimately what it comes down to is he can stall as long as it's still a consensual encounter, because they're still free to ask for their licenses back.
Why is it still consensual, though? That's the question. They have to do something affirmative, is what you're saying. They have to affirmatively ask for their licenses back, even though you just said a reasonable person wouldn't do that under these circumstances.
I think under maybe different facts, like if he wasn't asking them about their licenses, if he just started interrogating them about something else right away, then maybe they wouldn't feel free to ask for their licenses back. So this is one of the more interesting things about this case is there are a lot of different points where the seizure arguably began. And one reasonable view was that it began when the officer shifted the focus of the questions from the licenses to what they were doing there. So first, once Officer Etzel goes back to the truck, he asks maybe to repeat her information just to make sure what her license says is accurate. Then he asked Sitzberger to do the same thing, and Sitzberger's license actually says a different address than what he verbally provides, so his license was incorrect. And then Officer Etzel gets a little suspicious about that and says, wait a minute, your license, I forget which one, I think the license said Plymouth, Wisconsin, which is in Sheboygan County. He verbally said he lives in Waldo, but Officer Etzel thought that he was coming from somewhere in downtown Sheboygan where they were. And that's when he started to say, wait a minute, where do you live? What are you doing here? And that's when he shifted the focus away from the licenses to kind of maybe investigating what they were doing. But I think that's reasonable for a few reasons. First of all, the guy's on probation, so I still think it's a community caretaker thing to fill out a complete report for the probation officer. And I think it's reasonable suspicion, definitely, by this point. We're past the record check. He already knows what the drug overdose, knows what the guy being on probation. And once he starts saying, well, I came from my friend Jake's house. He's actually 2 blocks down the street. I don't know his last name. I've only known him for 5 or 6 months. He's my friend's ex-boyfriend. I don't really know him. I think it gets pretty suspicious at that point, almost to the level of probable cause, but we don't need to go that far. As long as it's reasonable suspicion, I think he could detain them until the drug dog showed up a couple minutes later.
Counsel, could you help me with this? What if the driver here and future drivers put a pin in your balloon and say, excuse me, by the way, officer, I don't consent to you taking my license back to the car. Now, the balloon is this belief that the driver has consented, this myth, this. But what if they actually make a statement like that? Then where do you go with that consent? And how does it fit into the issue before us of seizure?
Well, that would definitely be a much, much more difficult case. And I think at that point, the officer would be seizing them unquestionably by walking away with their license if they said, you don't have my consent to do that. So I think one option would be if he has a radio, like on his shoulder or somewhere, he could just maybe call dispatch that way. If they say, no, I don't want you running my record check at all. I just want you to look at my license for 5 seconds to verify that it, you know, the faces match. Then he probably has to give it back after 5 seconds. And if he doesn't, I think at that point, a court's going to have to decide whether there's a community caretaking function or not, if assuming the court doesn't decide that issue in this case. I do want to respond to something that Justice Amwalsh Bradley said a few minutes ago about this idea that people are using drugs if they're in their cars for a long time. I don't mean to be suggesting that that's necessarily the case. I'm just saying that Officer Edsel's testimony was based on his training and experience. People are often, not always, but often using narcotics if they're in a parked car for a very long time. I think the court should keep in mind that Officer Edsel is a night shift police officer, and he was working in the city of Sheboygan. This was downtown Sheboygan. It's a fairly big city by Wisconsin standards, and this happened, I believe, in November of 2017. And I think the opioid epidemic had already started by that point. So maybe all he's really getting at is, I've seen a lot of people, or at least heard coworkers finding a lot of people using drugs when we're out on the night shift in downtown Sheboygan. I think that's probably all he was getting at. So I don't mean to suggest that if a person's sitting in their car at 3 p.m. for 5 minutes that they're using drugs, that's not at all what the state's arguing. But I think the court should take his training and experience into account when deciding whether there might have been possible drug use going on.
And do we take his training and experience into account when he testified that they were not free to leave initially? Or do we discount that training and experience?
So it's a little weird that he did testify that they weren't free to leave. And I think he was a little vague or unclear about what time frame he was talking about. Presumably, I think he meant during the record check, but I'm not really sure what he meant when he said they weren't free to leave. But I don't think it's a subjective standard. It doesn't matter what Officer Edsel thought. It doesn't matter what Van Beek thought. It matters what a reasonable person in Van Beek's position would think. And under the way that sort of reasonable person standard has been fleshed out in case law going back decades by this court and the U.S. Supreme Court, I think a reasonable person would think that Van Beek was voluntarily surrendering her license. And one more thing I would be remiss to not talk about today. The standard, I think, is whether a reasonable person would think it was consensual still, not whether Van Beek was free to leave. And in fact, that Carpenter case I mentioned, the district court said the defendant in that case was not free to leave during the record check, so he was seized. The Eighth Circuit said, no, it was consensual, so he wasn't seized. And there are a bunch of cases that my brief and Van Beek's briefs cite that say a person under these circumstances is free to leave. Some say they're not. Other cases say it's about consent, and the state's view is that it's about consent. And I think the most important thing is getting the standard right, so courts and judges and lawyers and police officers know what the standard is going forward for whether there's a seizure. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, Attorney Pusick, are you ready for rebuttal?
I am, thank you. To jump off of what opposing counsel just said, I think I'd be remiss not to point out that of the jurisdictions that have considered this question head on, I think it's fair to say the vast majority of them would find that Ms. Van Beek was seized at some point after the officer took her license to his squad car. There's just a lot of authority for the proposition that an officer who retains and takes a license away from a person, no reasonable person would feel free to leave or otherwise terminate the encounter under those circumstances.
I just want to make sure I understand your position on the consent. Did Ms. Van Beek ever consent to the officer having her driver's license?
When she first handed it over, yes, I believe she gave it to him consensually. She did not consent to him taking it away to his squad car.
Okay, thank you.
Do you agree with your opposing counsel that the consent question is whether a reasonable person would understand, at least there, that the consent would have covered bringing it back to the car?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the question is, did Ms. Van Beek actually freely and voluntarily give him consent? I mean, I think that's what matters, that the state has that burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence.
Will you respond? Did you have a follow-up?
Just a follow-up. And if she consented, obviously, it doesn't matter if she wouldn't feel free to leave necessarily, because she consented to not leave when she consented to having the license go back to the car, right?
Well, I guess my question would be, what happens 2 minutes after the officer's back in his car and she goes, you know, on second thought, I want to withdraw my consent. I don't want to do this anymore. I have someplace to be. She is, as a matter of fact, prohibited from withdrawing that consent, which I think is a problem here.
That's just the scope of consent, right? I mean, if she consented for the license to be brought back to the car, she's voluntarily put herself in a position where she can't immediately ask for it back and leave, right?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I'd like to, before my time runs out, address...
Can I ask you one real quick question, though?
Sure.
Because when he gets back to the car, let's follow this consent issue. Even if she did consent to him checking the licenses, they get back, he gets back to the car. Is there a point at which your opposing counsel says they have to affirmatively ask for the licenses back? Otherwise, it's still consent. Can you respond to that?
No, I mean, of course they don't need to ask for it back. The standard is, would a reasonable person feel free to leave or otherwise terminate the encounter? And my argument is, if she doesn't, in that circumstance, of course, someone's not going to, you know, the idea that the person in Ms. Van Beek's shoes has to affirmatively assert that she wants to leave is sort of silly, because she, of course, if my argument is correct, she doesn't feel that she can do that freely because of the circumstances of this encounter. Addressing the Ellenbecker thing, I think it's a big stretch to say that Ellenbecker, and this is the community caretaker argument, Ellenbecker is similar to this case. I find nothing but dissimilarity between these two. Ellenbecker, you know, to invoke the community caretaker doctrine, the officer has to have a reasonable, objectively reasonable basis to believe that someone's in need of assistance, and he just doesn't have that here. In Ellenbecker, there was a guy on the side of the road with his hood up, jumper cables laying out, he's carrying a gas can. His vehicle was disabled, whether he said he needed help or not. He was somebody that was in the public in need of assistance. That is a big difference than what happened here. In addition to that, I think the holding in Ellenbecker is sort of very, you know, one of the other big differences is that the Court of Appeals pointed out was, look, you know, even if the officer had this license, Mr. Ellenbecker wasn't held there because of the officer's actions. It was because his car was disabled. And in that way, this case is similar to INS versus Delgado and Florida versus Bostic, where what was holding the person at the scene was outside of the officer's control. And of course, in this case, what was holding Ms. Van Beek at the scene was in the officer's control. It was his decision to take that license away. And so, I mean, I think the last thing I'd like to sort of point out is just for the court not to lose sight of what the body camera shows has happened here. We've got an officer who gets this call. He shows up. He doesn't think anything's going on. It sounds legit. It's nothing suspicious at all in his mind. He made that clear on the body camera video. But he's got this policy, and his supervisors want him to take people's names when he can get them. So he takes the licenses and he goes to where he's comfortable, which is his car. And he when he calls him in, he learns that she's got this drug overdose. And that single piece of information changed this his approach completely to this case. He immediately calls for a drug dog. He waits a minute and a half hoping to get a response. He doesn't get one. He goes and talks to the other officer on scene. He says, do I really have enough to just hold these guys here? He's telling us he knows he doesn't have enough, but he does it anyway. And then he engages in the dilatory questioning that I pointed out in my brief. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you both. Very, very interesting case. Just when you think you've seen everything about Fourth Amendment, you haven't, that's for sure. So thank you very much. Your briefs were helpful too. We are going to adjourn now so that people can get rearranged for our next argument this morning. We are adjourned.